the window of vulnerability, like the bomber gap and the missile gap before it, provided a strong rationale for increased spending on defense. And like those other scares, it was based more on fear than on facts. A successful surprise attack on America's land-based missiles wouldn't be easy to pull off. To achieve a 95% certainty of wiping them out, at least 2 Soviet warheads would have to be aimed at each silo. Those warheads would have to land in precisely timed intervals so that the blast effects of one didn't destroy the other. And the Soviets would have to prevent the Strategic Air Command from launching its missiles on warning. Even if the surprise attack were successful, disabling every single Minuteman and Titan II, the fallout from the nuclear blasts would kill somewhere between 2 million and 20 million Americans. And the United States would still have thousands of nuclear warheads mounted on submarine-based missiles ready to seek revenge. President Carter's idealistic vision soon collided with the reality of the late 1970s. He had to contend with gasoline shortages, high unemployment and inflation, anxieties about the decline of American power, the arms buildup in the Soviet Union, its crackdown on dissidents, its use of Cuban troops as proxies in Ethiopia and Angola. The Senate refused to approve another arms control treaty, and détente became a thing of the past. Instead of cutting the defense budget, Carter increased it for the first time in more than a decade. Instead of adopting a strategy of minimum deterrence, he endorsed a countervailing strategy that would allow the president to use limited nuclear strikes in a variety of situations. Instead of eliminating strategic weapons, he backed the development of entirely new ones. The MX long-range missile, the Pershing II medium-range missile, cruise missiles that used jet engines instead of rockets to fly low and evade Soviet radar, the B-2 bomber, the Trident submarine. The MX missile system embodied the strategic thinking of its time. To avoid destruction in a surprise attack, the MX would be mounted on a 200-foot-long truck. The missile would constantly be moved between 23 protective concrete shelters, like a pea in an immense shell game. The Soviet Union would never know which shelter housed a missile. The shelters would be a mile apart. 22 of them would contain fake missiles, and those decoys would also be moved constantly by truck. If the scheme worked, the Soviets would have to use at least 46 warheads to destroy a single MX missile. President Carter approved the deployment of 200 MX missiles in the Great Basin area of Utah and Nevada. The missiles would be scattered across roughly 15,000 square miles of federal land, most of it closed to the public. 8,000 miles of new roads would be built for access to the MX sites. About 100,000 workers would be required to construct the system, and about half that number to run it. The total cost of the project was estimated to be at least $40 billion. The new weapon was designed not only to close the window of vulnerability for the United States, but also to open one for the Soviet Union. Each MX would carry 10 highly accurate warheads, thereby placing Soviet missiles at risk of destruction during an American first strike. At about 11 o'clock in the morning on November 9, 1979, the computers at the NORAD headquarters inside Cheyenne Mountain said that the United States was under attack. The huge screen in the underground command center at SAC headquarters showed that Soviet missiles had been launched from submarines off the West Coast. The same message was received by computers in the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon and the alternate National Military Command Center at Site R inside Raven Rock Mountain. And then more missiles appeared on the screen, launched not only from submarines but also from sites within the Soviet Union. It was a massive attack, and warheads would begin to hit American targets within 5 or 6 minutes. Whenever NORAD's early warning sensors detected signs of a possible missile launch, a missile display conference was held. It happened about 4 times a day. The infrared sensors on the Air Force satellites could be triggered by forest fires, volcanic eruptions, and other sources of heat. The officers on duty would discuss whether the threat seemed real or merely a false alarm. The commander-in-chief of NORAD would decide if a threat assessment conference had to be arranged, bringing the head of SAC and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff into the discussion. That type of conference happened once or twice a week. And if missiles truly seemed to be heading toward the United States, a missile attack conference would be set up. It would give the president a chance to speak with senior officers, listen to their advice, and decide whether to launch missiles in retaliation. A missile attack conference had never been held. As the computer screens at NORAD filled with Soviet missiles, a threat assessment conference was called. Although the pattern of the attack seemed to fit with the Pentagon's assumptions about Soviet war plans, its timing made little sense. Tensions between the superpowers weren't particularly high, and nothing in the news seemed to warrant a bolt-from-the-blue attack on the United States. Duty officers at NORAD contacted the radar and ground stations whose sensors were relaying information about the launches. None of them had detected signs of any missiles. The NORAD computers seemed to be providing an erroneous but highly realistic account of a Soviet surprise attack. As a precaution, the klaxons were sounded at SAC bases nationwide. Bomber crews ran to their planes, and missile crews were put on heightened alert. Fighter interceptors took off to look for signs of a Soviet attack. The National Emergency Airborne Command Post left Andrews Air Force Base without President Carter on board, and air traffic controllers throughout the country prepared to clear America's airspace for military flights, warning every commercial airliner that it might soon have to land. As the minutes passed without the arrival of Soviet warheads, it became clear that the United States wasn't under attack. The cause of the false alarm was soon discovered. A technician had put the wrong tape into one of NORAD's computers. The tape was part of a training exercise, a war game that simulated a Soviet attack on the United States. The computer had transmitted realistic details of the war game to SAC headquarters, the Pentagon, and Site R. The computers at NORAD had been causing problems for more than a decade. Although they were perhaps the most important data processing machines in the United States, responsible for compiling and assessing information from all its early warning radars and satellites, the Honeywell 6060 computers were already obsolete when NORAD installed them within Cheyenne Mountain. A 1970